during the Sinai campaign. Dayan's personal study had shown him that the enemy almost invariably had the initiative on the battlefield, and he quoted Mao's rules of warfare verbatim. When the enemy advances, we retreat. When he escapes, we harass. When he retreats, we pursue. When he is tired, we attack. When he burns, we put out the fire. When he loots, we attack. When he pursues, we hide. When he retreats, we return. Suggesting that until these simple guidelines were acknowledged by our leaders, the enemy would continue to have the upper hand. Dayan confirmed many of my own thoughts, or more accurately, instincts on the war, which was a great relief given that they were thoughts I'd expressed that very afternoon to the chief of staff of our army. General Marshall, meanwhile, countered all the Israelis' arguments with, "We'll wear them down. No one can take the kind of punishment we're dishing out and win. Look at the Germans and the Japs." Finally, having now heard Vietnam compared to World War II twice in one day, by no less than the Army's boss and by one of America's top military analysts, I decided it was best to excuse myself and go home to wish Patty and the kids a happy Thanksgiving and a Merry Christmas. I won't be home for the next 4 months, you see. The poor Army family. Both United States Army Vietnam, USARV, and MACV's Saigon headquarters were incredibly plush, and worlds away from the city that throbbed just beyond their respective gates. Outside were taxicabs and bicycles, and beautiful girls with long black hair and lovely Ao Dais that flew like kites in the steamy breeze. Inside were charts and graphs and aides and assistants bustling busily through air-conditioned rooms. The staffs of both HQs, officer and enlisted, wore jungle fatigues complete with the new canvas black embossed insignia recently developed to be sniper-proof in the bush. They wore the cleated canvas boots of the warriors too, but unlike the real warriors, whose battle scars were mirrored in those boots rubbed white by rocks and undergrowth, these rear echelon commandos, or rear echelon motherfuckers, REMFs, as they were known in the parlance of Vietnam, were peacetime army perfection. The only thing mirrored in their gleaming polished boots were the overhead lights in their busy offices. I would have been amused by the whole scene if it weren't for the knowledge that the guys here in these pristine headquarters received the same combat pay as the soldiers who really did the job, living in the mud and risking their lives every day. The MACV briefing General Marshall and I received before we went into the field was suspiciously rosy in its assessment of how went the war, but it matched well the view SLAM had professed to Dayan and me in Washington. As such, the general was positively jubilant as we proceeded on to Saigon's Tansanut Airport. There, a VIP two-engine aircraft bearing a one-star red standard was waiting for us, its pilot, co-pilot, and crew chief all lined up in front of the plane waiting to salute and shake the hand of SLAM Marshal. This was a far cry from what I was used to. The way most guys got around Vietnam was by hitchhiking a ride, often after waiting at heliports and airports for hours, or even days. But with SLAM, it was red carpet treatment all the way. Doors held open, people bowing and scraping wherever he went, and not a moment's delay. Given his reputation and all the respect accorded to him, one who had never seen SLAM might easily imagine that he was an imposing presence like a MacArthur or a Gavin. He was not. On the contrary, SLAM Marshall was a small, very plump man in his mid-60s, whom one would be immediately forgiven for mistaking for an animated sack of potatoes rather than a flag officer. He was no doubt the most unmilitary-looking general since the Civil War. His uniform, which he always wore in the field, was permanently wrinkled World War II khakis or fatigues. His shirt pockets, which were always unbuttoned, were home to numerous felt-tipped pens, all sticking out. His fatigue cap had embossed on it, front and center, a general's star twice, perhaps three times larger than the regulation size. Marshall actually looked more like a caricature of a general than the real McCoy, but because he wore his ridiculous costume with complete self-confidence, while a trooper or an officer might look at him in utter amazement, he'd never, ever allow himself to laugh. When everyone at Tansanut had finished kissing SLAM's ring, we got into the VIP twin engine and took off on the first leg of what SLAM would describe 10 years later in his autobiography, published 2 years after his death in 1979, as my journey into disillusion. he would not be wrong. But all the sad and sorry revelations I would make were still well down the track that day at Tansanut, and for the first few weeks of my tour with Slam, I was perpetually high with the mission, the man, and the extraordinary opportunity being with him allowed me, as an outsider, to play in the inner circle of the general officer world. Our first stop was the 1st Air Cav Division's base camp at An Khe, where we were greeted effusively by its CG, Major General John Jack Norton. Norton was an old friend of Marshall's, the two having met in 1944 when Slam was doing his post-operation study of the Normandy invasion. Then a whiz kid Major Jack Norton had been G3 82nd Airborne for that operation. As the two men reminisced, I stood back and marveled at the metamorphosis of the 1st Air Cav's Highlands home. It bore almost no resemblance to the place the 1st of the 101st had secured for the Flying Horsemen in mid-1965. What had then been a village of perhaps 2,500 mostly mountain people had sprung up into a ticky-tacky cardboard instant city with more than 18,000 Viet and Montagnard camp followers. The jungle was gone. The Cav had chopped it away to build a barricade 18 kilometers in circumference, inside which was the base camp, a fine airfield, and the towering Hau Khao Mountain, which sat in the middle like a silent giant. Choppers and fixed-wing aircraft filled the sky overhead. Many more could be seen dotting the long runway, or in sandbagged revetments on either side. The 1st Air Cav truly was a going concern, and if ever one were looking for a we're-winning reading on the wartime barometer, An Khe was certainly it. General Marshall and I went to work immediately, setting up the first of four schools to teach his post-combat interviewing technique. Essentially, a copy of the system police used for reconstructing a crime, Marshall's method entailed bringing together the participants of whatever action was to be reviewed and, with a trained interviewer guiding the discussion, reconstructing that action as a group. For Slam's schools, the actions we examined were recommended to us by a unit's operations people or commander, and we conducted the interviews at the An Khe base camp or by visiting the participant units near their own positions. While each man, whatever his rank, was allowed to speak freely about what had happened on the ground, the reason the interviews were conducted in groups rather than with individuals was to minimize the bullshit factor. The men kept one another on track, so not only could a fuller picture be developed with everyone's input, but a truer one with a minimum of exaggeration. It was a very good system, and though the fighters eagerly did most of the talking, the interviewer was a crucial element, because a good one could capitalize on the tiniest scraps of information to get to the crux of a story. Yet the interviewing drill itself could be as simple as a trooper saying, "Small arms fire was tearing into us. I saw four men go down, and then I saw Whitey running up on my left holding a grenade," and then the interviewer breaking in to say to Whitey, who would also be among the participants gathered for the occasion, "Okay, Whitey, what happened then?" The object of the endeavor for Slam and me was not to draw conclusions about the fights we examined in the schools, though it would quickly prove unavoidable, like the disturbing observation that a year after Ya Drang, the Air Cav was still looking for big battles, still wargaming huge, totally unimaginative hammer and anvil operations a la Benning, though the enemy had long before reverted to economy of force tactics that made the Cav's World War II approach like swatting flies with a sledgehammer. Instead, our job was simply to train our students, all officers from the Army's military history detachments already in place in Vietnam, in a method of after-action scrutiny that could be easily set up and maintained in their own units. They were the ones to draw conclusions from their own battles while collecting their historical data and make any fallout lessons learned available to their commands to prevent the same mistakes being repeated in future engagements. A tireless worker, General Marshall, conducted all the interviews in the first school while the officer students observed the technique. Slam really was a master at it, with a natural feel for battle and a great understanding of squad and platoon tactics, his specialty. He also had a most incredible memory, bordering on total recall. On one occasion, he stunned everyone in the room when he turned to a burly old soldier platoon sergeant in his mid-30s and insisted he knew him, though the sergeant was positive they'd never met. "It's in my book, Night Drop," said Slam. I met you at Normandy right after the 82nd jumped in at Saint-Mary-Glise. You were in the 2nd Battalion, 325th Glider Regiment. No, sir, said the sergeant. That wasn't me. But I'll be damned if you're not talking about my older brother. He was in the 2nd of the 325th Glider, just like you say. We stayed at An Kay for 2 weeks, working solidly by day and enjoying the expansive hospitality of General Norton by night. The CAV CG was most supportive of SLAM's effort here in Vietnam and made sure our every need and comfort was looked after, both in the field and in the CAV's Hilton-like VIP quarters where we were put up. We ate in the general's mess, a room with three long tables forming a horseshoe, the head of which was reserved for the generals and VIP guests like SLAM. The staff and less important guests, like me, sat opposite one another at the two legs perpendicular to the general's table. And throughout each evening's three-course, five-star quality gourmet meal, presented on fine china embossed with the CAV insignia and served by black waiters in starched white coats, probably line infantrymen who found a home in the rear, we politely eavesdropped on what the VIPs were saying. There was little, usually no talk of war during these formal dinners. In fact, you'd never even know a war was going on unless the generator sputtered, coughed, and went out, plunging the room into darkness. Fortunately, an efficient generator operator, probably another line soldier who'd found the good life in the rear, would promptly switch on the backup unit, and the lights would go on all over the mess hall. Usually, this was just in time for after-dinner cigars, liqueurs, coffee, and conversation, at which time the guests normally told some well-worn anecdotes. SLAM was a marvelous storyteller, and as senior guest, most evenings of our stay with the CAV, he held the mess hall floor. One night, however, found him sharing the spotlight with author John Steinbeck, who was in Vietnam to visit his son, a radio announcer for Armed Forces Network in Saigon, and to take home all the good news on the war effort. In his last years in life, Steinbeck was in pretty shocking physical condition, particularly compared to Marshall, his contemporary. The two distinguished guests had equally healthy egos, though, and there soon proved to be insufficient room at the head table to contain them both. At the happy hour before dinner, the two old men had spent their time sniffing at each other like bulldogs. Throughout the meal, normally cheerful, twinkly-eyed Slam had been stony-faced as his Nobel Prize-winning rival showed him the respect he might show a copy boy for an insignificant weekly rag. When the dinner was finished, the two men spent the rest of the evening fighting for the floor to deliver their respective tales of the time I talked to kings or presidents, and by the time the whole thing was over, I'm sure I wasn't the only one to gratefully tumble into bed, absolutely exhausted. After reconstructing two of the first Air Cav's actions for the students of the first school, we said goodbye to Jack Norton and his luxurious An Kay home and flew off to the equally sumptuous 1st Division base camp at Da An. The base camp mentality in Vietnam was an outgrowth of the static days of the Korean War. Back then, the Vietnam-era generals had been majors and lieutenant colonels on the outside looking enviously in. No doubt many of them had thought, when I'm a general, I'll have that too. And now that they were going to, even if the base camps had even less place in this war than they had in the last. In Vietnam, a frontless war, the security requirement alone at these base camps was massive. At the 1st Air Cav, an entire brigade, fully one-third of the division, was engaged solely in protecting the unit's An Kay home. Similarly, by the time I'd left the 1st of the 101st in June, one-third of its combat power was tied up guarding Phan Rang. In the 1st of the 101st, this was particularly significant in that when we'd originally gone to Phan Rang, the position was almost Charlie free. But the longer we stayed, the more interest the enemy took in the place. By the time I left, they were regularly blowing up vehicles, lobbing an occasional mortar shell, and doing selective sniping. So almost by design, the base camp invited enemy activity, and then depleted the fighting strength of a unit in the effort to counter it. Frontline troop strength was continually drained, too, by the number of men needed to stay behind simply to service the base camps as they grew bigger and more plush. and in that the camps created an extra layer of diversion in which a trooper, fresh out of the hospital or back from R&R, could lose himself before returning to his unit, it wasn't long before these massive installations were really as much the enemy as the enemy himself. But you'd be hard-pressed trying to convince the high-living generals of that, or even Slam, who took to such splendor as if it were his God-given right. As for myself, no doubt I was initially seduced by the good life at On-K, and even at first in D-An, where I was assigned to share the air-conditioned bungalow, complete with a bar in the corner of the living room and a full-time Viet maid who kept shoes polished, clothes washed and pressed, and beds made with perfectly starched white sheets of one of the Big Red One's assistant division commanders, Bernard Rogers. But my enthusiasm disappeared pretty quickly when I saw the terrible complacency such living engendered. ADC Rogers, for example, emerged from his room each morning wearing pajamas and a dressing gown. Worse, even though the information we gained during Slam's schools exposed critical deficiencies in the U.S. effort from the level of the individual soldier the whole way up the chain of command, most of the generals at their evening happy hours seemed blissfully unconcerned, if not totally unaware, that any such problems existed. Operation Attleboro was a prime case in point. With more than 20,000 Americans involved at the height of the fighting, and more air and artillery used than on D-Day of the Normandy invasion, as of December 1966, Attleboro was the biggest operation of the war so far. And according to Colonel Stoutner, G3, 2 Field Force, who practically begged Slam to study it as part of his second school, it was nothing less than a classic, brilliant victory over the Viet Cong. But something smelled very funny to Slam and me about the perfectly planned, stunningly fought, triumphantly concluded battle. Our briefer's contention that the Viet Cong no longer controlled their time-hallowed refuge of War Zone D, for one thing, and indeed, when Slam and I took Stoutner's suggestion and turned our undivided attention to Attleboro, what we found was an operation that was rotten through and through. Attleboro was initiated in the middle of September by the 196th Brigade, the first U.S. brigade of its kind to fight in Vietnam. Less than a year before, the unit had been a band of 2,000 raw recruits. After 6 months of training from "this is a rifle" to the brigade in the attack, this instant unit had been declared combat ready and prepared to deploy to the Dominican Republic to replace the 82nd Airborne element that had been there since the beginning of the unrest. But at the last moment, the 196th was rerouted to Vietnam. The new destination would prove a hell of a place for them to have to wet their feet, because all declarations to the contrary notwithstanding, the 196th was not combat ready. The unit had not been trained correctly from the outset. The initial NCO cadre was mostly artillery or armor, and even the brigade's operational report for the period ending 31 October remarked that the serious shortage of infantry personnel made the training mission extremely difficult to execute. As Steve Prezenka always said, learn it right, and you'll do it right the rest of your life. Learn it wrong, and you'll spend the rest of your life trying to get it right. If the 196th's training mission was difficult to execute, it shouldn't have been hard for the powers that be to imagine how a combat mission would go. To make matters worse, Colonel Francis S. Conaty, the 196th's initial commander and a Medal of Honor winner with a reputation as a good infantry soldier, was relieved when the unit arrived in Vietnam and was replaced by one Brigadier General Edward H. DeSocher Jr., an artilleryman who had never before commanded or served in an infantry unit. So the stage was set for a very messy baptism of fire for the 1st Instant Brigade. From the commencement of Operation Attleboro, for almost 7 weeks the 196th had a leisurely walk in the sun. They made few contacts with the enemy but accomplished a lot in their wide-ranging mission by uncovering and destroying many VC supply depots and logistic installations. It wasn't until 3 November that the brigade's good life came to an end, when it became apparent the enemy was going to strike back. In good World War II fashion, General DeSocher requested and got the 25th Division's 1st of the 27th Wolfhound Battalion to act as the anvil, while two of the 196th's organic battalions played hammers to drive the VC into a killing zone. At least, that was the plan. On the ground, all intentions quickly went by the boards when C Company, 1st of the 27th, landed on a cold LZ and proceeded north right into a VC ambush that got them from the front, both sides, and the rear. Within 2.5 hours, the company had taken 14 WIA and 10 KIA, the latter figure including the company commander, the first sergeant, one of the platoon leaders, and one of the platoon sergeants, until the 127's battalion commander, Major Guy S. Sandy Malloy III, came and took control. The senior officer on the ground was a brand new second lieutenant on his first operation. A-127 was brought in to reinforce its battered sister company and was ordered to roll up the VC's flank. DeSocher, meanwhile, ordered 3 companies from 2 of his battalions to go to the rescue. All were made OPCON of the 1st of the 27th, giving CO Malloy control of 5 companies by the end of the first day's battle. By the end of the second day, a wounded Sandy Malloy was simultaneously commanding 11 rifle companies from 4 different battalions. In lethal action that found A-127 hanging on in the face of numerous frontal attacks after being ambushed just as C-127 had been the day before, DeSocher had begun to commit unit after unit piecemeal without rhyme or reason. Somehow all these units ended up under Malloy's operational control, and it was just fortunate that Malloy, the son of General Guy S. Malloy II, who 14 years before had taken such an interest in me at Fort Benning, was an able commander with a hell of a lot of troop duty experience under his belt. He fought his ad hoc mini-division beautifully for 30 straight hours, until Major General Dupuy, late of MAC V, now CG 1st Division, arrived to relieve Malloy's forces and take over the battle from the totally unqualified DeSocher. It was at this point, according to all the official reports, that the battle turned in favor of the Americans. Dupuy apparently decided to turn the entire region into a parking lot. Practicing what he preached as the author of the big U.S. search and destroy operations, he employed huge Rome plow bulldozers that plowed, ripped, and sheared through the jungle, leaving bare swaths 1,000 feet wide in which VC movement could be easily spotted from the air. In some areas, he had engineers use ditch-digging machines to slash into the Viet Cong's ingenious network of underground tunnels and bunkers, most of which, time would prove, remained untouched, unshaken, indeed undetected throughout the U.S. involvement, that ran through both war zones, C and D, like a poor man's subway system. Dupuy believed in maximum firepower, too. And by the time Attleboro was over, a total of 12 tons of TAC air, 35,000 artillery rounds, and 11 B-52 strikes had rained down on the enemy. Dupuy was actively and aggressively seeking what he called the enemy's threshold of pain, the point beyond which he believed the enemy could not sustain the punishment we were inflicting. It was his solution to end the war. Therefore, not unlike Sherman when he marched across Georgia, wherever Dupuy went, he left destruction in his wake. In the Iron Triangle, for example, more than 6,000 peasants were moved to refugee camps, and their abandoned villages were burned and bulldozed to the ground so their land could be declared a free fire zone, with anyone caught within it considered VC, fair game for all choppers and spotter planes that hunted there. Defoliants like Agent Orange were sprayed frequently throughout the first Div's AO of war zones C and D, and the ground had been bombarded so frequently by B-52 strikes that it looked from the air as if it had been pressed in a waffle iron. Dupuy would have had no complaints from me for what appeared to be his Napoleonic, the weaker the infantry, the heavier the employment of cannons philosophy. There was no question that using firepower was better than wasting lives, but the problem was that a lot of lives were being wasted too. Each day, Aslam and I collected our information on Attleboro. Visiting unit after unit that had somehow been involved, I got more and more depressed to find the same problems occurring, the same lethal mistakes being made again and again, and they were the exact mistakes we'd made in the 1st of the 101st as far back as a year before. The Viet Cong, those dumb country hicks, or so we perceived them, were still fleecing us city slickers every day. Irrespective of Attleboro's official report of victory, the fact was that the operation, which claimed 155 U.S. lives and another 741 WIA, was just another case of dancing to the enemy's tune, a tune written years before during the Indochina War. The tactics the NVA and Main Force VC employed at Attleboro were right out of Street Without Joy. The standard bitch of the French, "I just know the little bastards are somewhere around here, but go and find them in that mess," was the same complaint Slam and I heard again and again from the Yankee long noses a dozen years later, as their accounts of the fight revealed that the VC initiated or controlled almost every action. During Attleboro, they sucked U.S. units into well-prepared killing zones, almost a replay of the lure we fell for at Mi Con, and then ate the Americans up at eyeball-to-eyeball range. All our men could do was try their damnedest to extricate their dead and wounded and themselves and get some distance so they could hammer the enemy with our unbeatable firepower. And yet, when I asked the company and battalion commanders who'd participated in Attleboro whether they'd read Bernard Fall's basic primer on the war, few could answer in the affirmative. During our reconstruction of Attleboro, Slam and I found that other U.S. units were being devastated without meeting the enemy at all. In the 199th Infantry Brigade, for example, one company had taken 60 casualties over a three-month period, 40 of which had been from booby traps, generally constructed of American debris and generally emplaced by the VC throughout war zones C and D. I did a quick calculation of how many of the remaining 20 had been friendly fire WIAs, and when it was all shaken out, the enemy might as well have stayed home. "To subdue the enemy without fighting," said Sun Tzu, "is the acme of skill." This is not to say that these U.S. units were not making any kills. At Attleboro alone, the enemy KIA body count was reported to be 1,106. The number of individual weapons captured during the fighting at Attleboro was only 141, however, which made that body count highly suspicious. While a 4-to-1 body count to weapons captured ratio was fairly reasonable, 12-to-1 was extremely unlikely. The operations Slam and I studied were hurting the enemy, but it was not at a price the opposition could not sustain. According to one of the basic principles of guerrilla warfare, if the G is not losing, he is winning, and if the G's opponent is not winning, he is losing. As long as the VC and NVA could sustain their losses, they were not losing the war, whatever defeats their foe ascribed to them. And there was no reason to believe they would not be able to continue to sustain their losses, even in the face of Westy and Dupuy's search-and-destroy tactics and the rich man's war the Americans were waging. If the VC and NVA lost at Attleboro, it was a conscious decision to run away to fight another day. No doubt they would go to ground and lick their wounds, but just as had been the case in the Indochina War, going to ground was just the first step in rebuilding, in strengthening their ranks and their will to prepare to meet us again on the very same ground as before. So even if Operation Attleboro was a victory for the U.S. in the World War II sense, that is, we held the high ground at the end of the battle, in terms of the material losses in both choppers and ammo used, in the number of U.S. dead and wounded, and the fact that the enemy would and did move right back into the area the minute our units pulled out, Attleboro was a Pyrrhic victory at best. But no one wanted to know. While all the generals Slam and I met seemed wholly behind our endeavor, none showed any real interest in the findings the schools uncovered. The same base camp complacency that did not see the need for self-examination in the first place had led to what appeared to be a total absence of curiosity, even when the hard work was done for them, about what was happening around them. I would have liked to tell these generals what we were learning on those many occasions when, to my utter amazement, one or another sought my advice in some future plan. But since Slam never broached the severity of the problems when he was turned to for guidance, I certainly didn't think it was my place. I should have gone right ahead, though. By the time we'd finished the second school, I realized that in the power game I was way ahead, and could probably have said anything I damn well pleased. Traveling with Slam, I was accorded respect well beyond that due my rank of light colonel. I was not a general, and I didn't belong, but the real generals seemed to forget that, or put it aside. For the purpose of the trip, at least, I was one of them. It didn't hurt that I was representing the Office of the Chief of Military History on the express recommendation of the Army Chief of Staff. Everybody assumed I was tight with General Johnson, and again I found flag officers who wouldn't even have acknowledged my presence at other times, slapping my back and acting out the role of big buddies. I was knocked out that the guys who wore stars still had to play the political game, and even more so that they thought I had the power to give any one of them a little career jump. And it was General Dupuy, of all people, who was the most striking example of those who sought to take advantage of my close relationship with the chief. William Eugene Dupuy was considered by insiders to be the prime architect of America's war in Vietnam, and a principal in the development of U.S. frontier strategy there. He was an extraordinarily brilliant man, or so went the word, who had made his name as a staff officer, having had little command experience at all and none on the company level. After he took over the Big Red One, Dupuy quickly became infamous throughout Vietnam for on-the-spot relief, firing some 30 battalion commanders, most within days of their arrival. While this was actually more the work of Dupuy's no-bullshit ADC for tactics, James Hollingsworth, a gravelly-voiced, colorful character who cursed a blue streak, had 5 Purple Hearts from Africa, Sicily, and Europe during World War II, and was undoubtedly the real power and spirit behind the 1st Division. Jim Hollingsworth went on to become one of the most effective high-level advisors of the Vietnam War. At An Loc in 1972, he virtually took command of Arvin's 3 Corps and used B-52s like TAC Air to stop the major NVA offensive dead in its tracks. What was interesting was how when Dupuy finally settled on the battalion commanders he wanted, their average height was at least 6 feet. It was a Frederick the Great thing, I was sure. Dupuy himself was very short and ferret-like in both look and manner, and whenever I saw him conferring with his towering subordinates, I couldn't help but think of old Frederick and his runt complex. Still, Dupuy could go on to have an unparalleled impact on the Army. Under his continued patronage, in subsequent years his hand-picked Praetorian Guard would slip into the Army's top jobs. Dupuy himself would never go all the way to Chief of Staff or Supreme Commander NATO, but his incredible influence as a power broker in the top tiers of the Army would have much to do with who did and who did not. Later still, he would expand his base and take on his most ignoble role, that of undeclared head of the crusade to rewrite the history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, of which he was so much a part. But that was all in the future. In 1966, Dupuy was already a powerful, powerful guy, so I was totally unprepared for the ingratiating smile he flashed me when Sam and I arrived at D'An, or the way he took me aside as soon as he could for a private word. Though I'd met with him quite regularly the previous year when, as J3 of MACV, he'd visited me in my S3 role with the 1st of the 101, one thing I never would have expected would be to be greeted by Dupuy like a long-lost brother. Dupuy was even more fawning and deferential to Marshall, but since most of the generals we met treated Slam not unlike a king, in that respect his behavior was unremarkable. "Hack," he said, "I'd like you to do me a favor if you get a chance when you talk to the chief. Just tell him I'm a good man. And tell him, sure, I curse and carry on a bit, but it's all an act. It's what the troops in the Big Red One expect. So if you could just tell him I'm a good man." Slam and I spent Christmas with the 1st Division. On the 26th, Bob Hope gave his traveling show for a huge Big Red One crowd. It seemed like madness to assemble such a large target for VC mortars and rockets, but the antagonists had declared a ceasefire, and the show went on despite intelligence reports that the Viet Cong would strike during the Christmas truce. I didn't go, besides the fact that it was mind-boggling to me that Dupuy would take such a mammoth risk with the lives of his men. I'd made a practice of missing Bob Hope shows since Korea, because I didn't like his slick brand of humor, and I just preferred to stay with my unit and avoid all the confusion. Slam, on the other hand, was a Bob Hope fan and a distinguished guest at the performance. He was still chuckling when I met him after his return and repeated what he considered the classic Hope joke. The U.S. bombing raids on North Vietnam are the best slum-clearing program Uncle Ho ever had. The following day, still during the ceasefire, a VC unit ambushed a 1st Division platoon whose patrol also violated the truce. The ambush took place less than 2 clicks from the now-vacant Bob Hope venue, with the VC armed with both a machine gun and a mortar. A day earlier, they would have made some impact on that show. The Americans took 7 KIA and several WIA in yet another classic no-one's-learning scenario. A young OCS-trained lieutenant had allowed his platoon to cross a wide-open rice paddy. The first I heard of the incident was when Dupuy came dashing into the general's mess as excited as a second lieutenant going to his first guard mount. He told Slam to saddle up. They were off to battle. As Dupuy dashed out again with Slam in hot pursuit, I marveled at this incredible example of over-supervision. A division commander rushing to the scene of one of his platoon's open-and-shut screw-ups? Where were the platoon's company and battalion commanders? Where was the brigade commander? From the information Slam's schools were routinely revealing, most likely they would be on scene as well, overhead in choppers, all of them issuing orders and playing what became known as the Great Squad Leader in the Sky, creating absolute chaos in an already confused situation. Such was not the way to win a war, but the longer the war went on, the worse this situation got, as many senior officers saw their units' fights and patrols only in terms of the glory it could bring them, or in terms of the medals and ribbons they could win, awards so common that they only became conspicuous by their absence in a guy's fruit salad, without leaving the beyond rifle range comfort of 1,200 to 1,500 feet. The worst case I heard while with Slam of the Great Squad Leader Syndrome was one of a platoon leader who, pushed for time by his Great Squad Leader in the Sky, ordered his men to use a well-traveled trail through the jungle. The unit fell victim to a single command-detonated Claymore mine set up along the trail. The result was 8 wounded and 7 killed, the latter figure including the lieutenant who, according to survivors, had always made a point of traveling through the bush and never using trails. In the case of Dupuy's and Slam's dash toward the sound of guns, by the time they arrived on the scene, the guns were silent. There was little to do but evacuate the dead and wounded and come home, which they did. For New Year's Eve, I took Slam with me to a party at the New York bar on Tudor Street in Saigon. The place was owned and operated by my dear friend John Westmoreland, who, since his battlefield commission in my fighter company in Korea, had risen through the ranks to make light colonel. I was so proud. After a couple of early 60s tours of Vietnam, he'd recently quit the army, joined the State Department detachment as a civilian, and come back to the war zone, where he'd made a life for himself. He'd met and married a Vietnamese woman named Jackie, who had a penchant for having children and making money. They had 1 kid already, as well as 2 or 3 very successful bars on Tudor Street. My personal favorite was the New York, with its mirrored walls, Laminex tables, each separated from the next by a curtain, and big American tape decks that blared out down-home country and western and popular Beatles tunes. Troops went there on pass to fall in love with any one of Westie's resident tea ladies, those fragile Oriental dolls who melted hearts with their lies. "I see you one time. I love you too much." The boys fresh out of the bush didn't care, as long as they could pretend it was true. Westie had a cozy corner organized for us when we arrived at the bar, and a strikingly beautiful good-time girl for Slam. I'd been more than a little apprehensive about taking him along. Anyone with a discerning eye would say that the New York, like most of the bars on Tudor Street, was actually pretty sleazy, but it proved to be a wasted worry. Slam loved the place. The hardest part of the evening was actually in getting from the front door to the table. Very rarely did one see a general on Tudor Street, so when Marshall walked in wearing his distinctive rumpled khakis and huge general star, it caused a tremendous stir, to his great delight. The rest of the evening was drunkenly wonderful. Slam displayed an incredibly earthy side which meshed perfectly with Westmoreland's, and when the new year came and went and Westie suggested we go back to his house to continue the party, Slam was all for it. So everyone paired off, made our way to John's villa, and drank our way through the dawn. At some stage in the wee hours, Slam and his tea lady disappeared, and I had a good chuckle thinking the old fox had gotten or was getting his ashes hauled by the Viet Bar girl. She was probably the first Vietnamese civilian he'd even talked to. Sadly, all was not as it appeared. In the morning, before I stumbled out of his house, Westy told me the girl had reported in on her night with Slam. "General have many things in head, but nothing in dick," she'd said. "He go to sleep right away. But number one general, big man." Months before, still in Washington and thinking I was stuck in the Pentagon for life, I'd written an article titled "No Magic Formula" to pass on some of the knowledge I'd gained fighting with the 1st of the 101st in Vietnam. With my deputy Bill Kesterson's magic edit and polish, we'd forged it into a great piece, and I'd sent it to Gentleman Jim Timothy, my old CO, now a general and assistant commandant at Fort Benning. Tim had said it would be published in Infantry Magazine early in the new year. So when Slam and I arrived at the 173rd Airborne Brigade's base camp at Bien Hoa, I was surprised to see a stack of mimeographed advance copies of the article on the desk of the 173rd's CG, Brigadier General John Dean. Even more surprising, I found that Dean had attached a glowing cover letter to each copy addressing my qualifications to write same. As Chief of Staff of 1st FFV under Swede Larsson, John Dean had been my endorser on the special ER rendered for my short tenure as the 1st of the 327th Battalion Commander. Apparently, the piece was mandatory reading within the 173rd. It would be a tremendous understatement to say I was very proud of that. But as pride goes before a fall, it was soon evident that few of the brigade soldiers at Bien Hoa had done their homework. The 173rd, now the oldest serving U.S. Army maneuver unit fighting in Vietnam, was battle-scarred, but not battle-wise. Commanders seemed preoccupied with the big picture. They didn't notice how the small things, the things that made a unit effective and prevented unnecessary casualties, were slipping, and slipping badly. Guys were using soap, toothpaste, and shaving cream before operations. They were smoking and wearing mosquito repellent on patrol. I even saw one guy returning from patrol bopping along to the strains of Jimi Hendrix pouring out of a portable radio the kid had bought at the PX and carried with him into the field. Few NCOs and company-grade officers were doing anything about the slow disintegration. Old NCOs were already getting scarce, and the young captains weren't with their companies long enough to make a dent. More than a few of the men Slam and I talked to didn't even know their company commanders' names. It was a bad situation, and one made all the more worrisome by the fact that the 173rd had some of the better officers, NCOs, and enlisted men we'd seen among the units we'd examined to date. If an elite airborne outfit like this one was falling apart, what more could possibly be expected from the average, unglamorous, foot-slogging infantry unit? Visiting the 173rd was not an uplifting way to begin the new year. Fortunately, the next stop was my old home, the 1st Brigade, 101st Airborne Division at Phan Rang, and there my spirits were lifted instantly. Unlike any other regular unit I observed during my tour with Slam, the Screaming Eagles were routinely employing tactics that actually fit the war. General Pearson, still in charge after almost a year, called them semi-guerrilla tactics. Stealth, deception, and surprise, units infiltrating the battlefield at night and without the use of choppers or accompanying artillery H&I. Basically, they were evolvements on what Hank Emerson had developed a year earlier, and they worked. The 1st of the 327 was being commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Joseph E. Collins, son of retired four-star J. Lawton Collins, and the unit looked great, particularly the Tigers, who netted 5 dead VC and 5 weapons in a classic ambush the day Slam and I arrived. Gunfighter Emerson's old outfit, the 2nd of the 502nd, was now in the infinitely capable hands of the gunslinger Lieutenant Colonel Frank Dietrich, a paratrooper since World War II who'd come up through the ranks. Dietrich was also a featured hero as F. Dietrich Berkeley in Ross Carter's one-of-a-kind book of war stories and war truths, Those Devils in Baggy Pants. At one stage during Geronimo 1, the 37-day 1st of the 101 operation we started to examine for Slam's third school, Dietrich maneuvered his entire battalion into 1 square mile of thick jungle to box in an estimated 100 NVA soldiers who'd fired on a Recondo patrol. It was a measure of the fine discipline among the 2nd of the 502nd troopers that not a single friendly fire casualty resulted from this very tight, very dangerous situation. As the operation continued, over 3 days of fighting, the O2 killed 41 enemy and took 36 prisoners on the way to rendering the 5th Battalion, 95th NVA Regiment, ineffective as a fighting unit. Dietrich's was the biggest engagement of the Geronimo campaign, but there were other equally impressive ones, like the Dawn ambush in which a very patient reinforced squad of 15 men killed 19 NVA, took one prisoner and 18 weapons for no casualties of their own. The significance of Geronimo 1 lay in its close to 10-to-1 enemy-to-friendly kill ratio, the very high weapons-to-body count ratio, 143 weapons, individual and crew served, to 149 enemy dead, and the fact that many of the 76 prisoners taken had voluntarily surrendered in the face of the American Brigade's superior tactics, economy of force tactics that gave the enemy a taste of their own medicine. I was elated. There was no question that the continuity of General Pearson's command over the past year and his openness to good ideas were essential ingredients in the brigade's success. But I also knew that if the first of the 101's procedures, starting with its basic philosophy of know your enemy, became a standard among U.S. units, we could have the same success all over the Vietnam battlefield. We would be able to beat this foe. We'd be able to fight the same protracted war of attrition the enemy was willing to fight without paying the heavy, heavy price in American lives. The Screaming Eagles were proving again and again that alert, well-trained soldiers could out-G the G. I shared my enthusiasm with Slam, but he was more distracted than impressed. "Their load's too heavy, Hack," he said, and proceeded to give me his well-developed World War II argument about the soldier's load. He'd written a book about it, and how too much weight will exhaust a trooper long before the first shot is fired. What he said was absolutely correct, but the point he missed was this was not World War II, where there was a front and a main supply route right behind, from where goodies could be brought up as required, or that resupply Vietnam style by chopper would compromise the paratroop guerrilla's very modus operandi. Neither would Slam acknowledge that while the troopers' loads were heavy when they went into an AO, centralized caches in the bush kept the men light when it came time to fight. And when I suggested that for the first time since we'd arrived in Vietnam we were seeing a regular American unit doing it right, Slam said irritably, "Let's face it, Hack, there's no juice here." No juice was Slam's way of saying there was no stuff at the first of the 101st for a book. No Vietnam War night drop or the river in the gauntlet or Pork Chop Hill. Immediately I could feel my face burning. I'd known for some time Marshall wasn't concerned about the schools we were running for the military history detachments, but I hadn't realized he, the military operations analyst, as he sometimes called himself, had no higher purpose at all in his analysis of military operations. When we first planned the trip, Slam had talked about visiting every one of the 10 divisions and separate brigades in Vietnam, which we eventually did. I'd suggested we streamline the effort by conducting not 4 schools, but 1 at An K, and bringing all the student officers there. The interviewing technique was the same wherever it was taught and regardless of the action being scrutinized, and I'd figured there would be plenty of material to work with even if we just reviewed the first CAVS operations since July. Besides, it didn't make sense to go hopping and rushing all over the country when the students could come to us. But Slam had put his foot down. "We must visit every unit," he said. "I want to cover all the major U.S. Army campaigns since I left in June." Logistically speaking, this was a moderate pain in the neck, because it meant we had to take all the student officers with us when we went from unit to unit. But even that would have been okay, except it soon became clear that Slam, whose job it was to teach these men being flown all over South Vietnam at the Army's expense, couldn't have been less interested in them or whether they learned the technique at all. Not just in the first one, but in all 4 schools, the military history detachment officers sat on the sidelines and watched while the general conducted the actual interviews. Slam never placed them in charge or asked them any questions. In truth, he simply ignored them. Meanwhile, every evening Slam counted the longhand pages of notes he'd taken that day, as most people would count money. He'd glance through the pages, noting all the soldiers' names, which he'd taken down during the interviews, perhaps even more assiduously than the action. "Every name is worth 10 books at the cash register," he'd declare. So even before the no juice comment, I'd recognized that Slam's priorities on this trip were not the same as the chief's or mine, or the officers of the military history detachments who traveled with us. But I was still not prepared for his reaction when, about a quarter of the way through our examination of Geronimo 1, Jack Norton called from On-K to say a hell of a fight had just finished around an air cav fire support base, FSB designated LZ Bird, and Slam ought to come up and have a look. "Wind it up," Slam directed me, fire in his eyes for the first time since we hit the first of the 101st. Already he was seeing in his mind's eye another Pork Chop Hill, commercially his most successful book, only this time he'd call it LZ Bird and keep the TV rights. He'd given them away for Pork Chop Hill and often talked about how, as a result, he felt sick every time the film of his Korea story played on the tube and he didn't get a red cent. "I'll never let that happen again," he'd vow each time he wound up his lament on the subject. So we folded our tent at the Screaming Eagle's Nest and headed back to the first air cav, where Slam got all he needed for his book. He also made sure the cav CO on the ground at LZ Bird, a captain who'd led his men courageously in the very heavy hand-to-hand battle, was put in for the Medal of Honor. Unfortunately, this generosity of spirit on Slam's part was, I knew by now, as calculated as it was real. Besides the boost to book sales he envisioned, should the real-life lead figure therein win the big one, the award would be another notch on his own belt, because Marshall had a thing about making heroes. One of his favorite pastimes was dropping names, generally in the context of his having made the subject, who was usually some illustrious 3- or 4-star general, past or present, and a favorite Korea tale was the one in which, through his clever prose and big-league contacts, he got the Medal of Honor for Lou Millette and his bayonet charge. By the time of the LZ Bird episode, I'd grown used to his chatter, so I silently wished the captain presently the recipient of Slam's attention well in the Blue Max stakes, and tried to let the rest of the affair wash over me. But it was hard to watch an idol moving closer and closer to the edge of the pedestal I'd placed him on. Despite his glowing reputation, I was beginning to see that Slam was less a military analyst than a military ambulance chaser, more a voyeur than a warrior, the Luella Parsons of the U.S. Army, because although it was the first of the 101st's hard-learned, well-proven economy of force tactics that held the key to winning the war, wearing the enemy down on our terms for a change without paying the price, Sam responded only to heroes and heroics, men fighting against impossible odds and, as necessary for the drama, dying. This wasn't to say he was a bloodthirsty man. It's just that that was how he saw war. But that wasn't something I understood at the time. We never did return to the brilliant Operation Geronimo 1 or the juiceless first of the 101st. Instead, we went up to play coup and the mostly drafty 4th Division, an outfit relatively new to the war. As we had with all units to date, we told the division's G3 we wanted to review what he considered one of the more significant actions his unit had been involved in. Without hesitation, he chose Paul Revere 4, an operation conducted along the Cambodian border the previous November, and suggested we meet in 1 hour's time for a full briefing. I was amazed. It usually took at least a day to organize such things. Promptly an hour later, however, the briefing officer and his entourage appeared before us with the full set of color charts and graphs and the slickest presentation I'd seen throughout my time with Slam. It was a fine diversion, especially considering that the content was nothing new. Paul Revere 4, we were told, was a classic encounter. Ho-hum, here we go again, I thought as we heard how early intelligence had picked up a large NVA element which the 4th Division and some OPCON units promptly and skillfully deployed around, how the U.S. forces proceeded to push their foe into a trap in which the enemy was savagely punished and all but destroyed, with the tattered remnants limping across the border into Cambodia while the Americans marched home in glorious victory. Slam and I exchanged more than one dubious glance as the briefing went on. We'd heard it all before, in unit after unit. Though the numbers always changed, the victories remained decisive. When it was all over, I couldn't help but ask the briefing officer how he'd gotten the remarkably comprehensive presentation together so quickly. "This briefing is the same one we gave to General Westmoreland, General Wheeler, Earl G. Buzz Wheeler, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Defense Secretary McNamara a few days ago, sir," he replied crisply, as briefing officers tend to do. We began our interviews with the 4th Division participants. Then I went to the POW camp and interviewed all the prisoners taken during the battle. This examination of the POWs, coupled with the horror stories of 4th Div troops whose squads or platoons were chewed up and spat out by their NVA opponents, revealed that there was almost no correlation between the official Army report on Paul Revere IV and what actually happened on the ground. I was astonished. There was no question that our boys had performed heroically, and no question that the enemy had been punished, the official figure was more than 1,000 KIA, by the Americans' incredible firepower. And our boys did hold the terrain at the end of the battle, even if it was an empty chunk of steaming jungle. So if the operation were measured against our World War II experience, it was indeed a victory. But if Paul Revere IV was viewed as it had to be, from the perspective of the war of insurgency that it was, then we did not win and were not brilliant. In fact, we were stupid, lethally so. And Charles won the day. The enemy initiated the action, used tried-and-true Highlands methods, that is, threatening a CIDG border camp and using NVA decoys to entice U.S. forces into an air-mobile operation. The enemy sucked the American units into well-dug-in killing zones along the Cambodian border, killing more than 140 and wounding more than 560 of our men on terrain that favored them completely. Once they'd accomplished their mission, they could scoot right across the border to regroup. As General Vol Nguyen Giap, North Vietnam's Minister of Defense, later wrote of the operation in his September 1967 statement on the war, "In the High Plateau area, the LAF, Liberation Armed Forces, lured the U.S. troops into coming to Plei Jurang, the CIDG camp pivotal to the action of Paul Revere IV, and annihilated them in bloody battles along the banks of the Sa Ti River." While neither Slam nor I would have used the word annihilate to describe U.S. losses, after reconstructing the battle, our assessment of Paul Revere IV did in fact track much more closely with Jop's than with the sanitized U.S. report of the events. That the official and true stories of Paul Revere IV were so distinctly different was bad enough, though really it was just a question of degree in relation to the only slightly less glowing and slightly more true reports we'd seen previously in unit after unit. But what was worse was that for the first time I realized that probably no one at the very top had any idea that the official reports were wrong. Slam knew, and he agreed with me that there was a regular and heavy-handed use of the M1 pencil in the effort to put our debacles in their best light. But if the M1 pencil was being applied starting at the company level, with embellishments added all the way up the chain of command, whatever underpinnings of truth remained by the time these reports got to division and corps were probably accidental. So from there, these reports, reports like Paul Revere IV, full of relatively honest but totally false optimism, made it all the way back to Washington unchallenged, and then they became the basis of critical decisions made on the war. It was the study of Operation Paul Revere IV that most profoundly shook what Slam would later call my almost childlike faith in the honesty of the after-action reporting system. But it was Slam himself who sent me hurtling down the road toward disillusion at this time, because he saw as clearly as I did what was going on and didn't raise a finger or utter a word to try to change it. It wasn't as if he didn't have the power or the influence to do so. Slam had made himself virtually a one-man media effort to keep the American public informed on how the war was going. Besides his soon-to-be-released book, he had a syndicated newspaper column and regular TV and radio shows, all of which he continued to write and or tape while we were in Vietnam, and he had the ear of every CG in the country, including Commuse Mac V. Westmoreland. Only after Paul Revere IV did I reflect on a conversation Slam and I had had a short time before, after I'd witnessed, from a respectful distance, what appeared to be an animated friendly talk between Marshall and General Westmoreland. Slam had returned to my side and promptly informed me that Westy's a dumb shit who didn't know what he was doing. At the time, I was flabbergasted by the comment, but now I wondered what the hell else Slam expected if the information Westy got was rah-rah bullshit such as we'd heard about Paul Revere IV. I felt Slam had a responsibility to tell Westmoreland and the rest of the establishment the truth about what was happening to the war effort, but instead, he continued to play the distinguished guest at every unit and ruffled no feathers. I didn't get it. If Marshall had the balls to tell me that Westy was a dumb shit who didn't know what he was doing, why didn't Slam have the courage to take a real stand on the mess we were making of the war instead of falling back on the, we have firepower on our side, the NVA can't sustain those losses, we'll wear him down, argument? As our trip drew to a close, my observations gained throughout began to line up to form a very bleak picture. It wasn't just that we were losing the war. Instinctively, I'd known that was the case for a long time. But what I couldn't have guessed was how much faster we were losing than I had imagined. To me, General Westmoreland was like the poker player who hadn't won a pot all night. In the desperate hope of changing his fortunes, he kept bumping the ante and forcing everyone to play faster. But it seemed he was throwing good money after bad.